at daylight, saw the enemy's combined fleet from east to east-southeast, bore away, made the signal for order of sailing and to prepare for battle, the enemy with their heads to the southward. At seven, the enemy wearing in succession. May the great God whom I worship grant to my country and for the benefit of Europe in general a great and glorious victory, and may no misconduct in anyone tarnish it, and may humanity after victory be the predominant feature in the British fleet. For myself individually, I commit my life to him who made me, and may his blessing light upon my endeavours for serving my country faithfully. To him I resign myself, and the just cause which is entrusted to me to defend. Amen. 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 So, Tom, that was the last diary entry by Horatio Nelson on the morning of Monday, the 21st of October, 1805. Very stirring words, I have to say. And we have been talking about the build-up to the Battle of Trafalgar, the long decades of maritime history, the development of the Royal Navy, the financial and political underpinnings, the extraordinary manoeuvrings to and fro across the Atlantic as Nelson chases Villeneuve, his French antagonist. And now here we are, the moment of decision. The dawn is coming, and I know you're poised to take us through blow by blow the narrative.
Yes, so it's just before dawn on the 21st of October, 1805, about 5:45 in the morning, and the lookouts on the masts of the British fleet spy the enemy. They're about 12 miles downwind from the British fleet. And it's confirmation that the French and Spanish have not withdrawn, have not retreated, and therefore there is an opportunity for battle. So the British are about 22 miles off Cape Trafalgar, which lies between Cadiz and Gibraltar. Taraf el-Ghar, so Arabic, the point of the cave. It's a clear day. The previous day had been wet, had been cloudy, very poor visibility, but on the 21st of October, it's about 21 degrees, so pretty unseasonably warm, but just the faint hint of a swell. So possibility of a storm coming
later
in due course, but the day itself, 21st of October, looks a good day to be fighting a sea battle. The British have 26 ships. The French and Spanish between them have 33 ships. The French and Spanish ships have been kind of mixed up so that there's no prospect of either one national squadron sailing off and abandoning the other. The French flagship is the Bucentaur, named after the gilded barge of the Doge in Venice. That is where Villeneuve is. It's not in absolutely tip-top shape because it had just recently been struck by lightning, which is further added to Villeneuve's kind of slight mood of despondency. And Villeneuve is in the center of the line as it's sailing down towards Gibraltar. He has with him a Spanish rear admiral, Baltasar de Cisneros, and he is in command of the Santissima Trinidad, so the most sacred trinity.
The biggest ship in the world.
And it's the biggest ship in the world. It's the only one with four decks of guns.
Yeah.
So an absolute trophy. British are absolutely itching to get their hands on it. The vanguard is commanded by another Spanish admiral, Ignacio de Alva, and he's on a ship called the Santa Ana. And the rear guard is commanded by a Frenchman, Pierre Dumanoir, he is on board a ship called the Formidable. The Spanish admiral, the overall commander, Frederico Gravina, he is on a ship called the Príncipe de Asturias, and he is commanding what Villeneuve calls the Squadron of Observation, which is basically a kind of reserve. So this is the plan that Villeneuve suspects what Nelson is going to do, and so he doesn't know where Nelson will be targeting his attack, and so his plan is that he's going to have, you know, this tactical reserve to kind of come up wherever it's needed. So that's the plan. Meanwhile, of course, Nelson has his plans. He has told all the captains of the ship, of the fleet, exactly what he's going to do. Namely, he's going to form two prongs. One of them is going to be led by himself on victory. The other one is going to be led by Admiral Collingwood, Nelson's old friend, the man that he most respects and admires among his colleagues. And he is going to be on a ship called the Royal Sovereign. So essentially, Nelson and Collingwood are the tip of the spear. They are in the position of maximum danger. And there's some nervousness about this on the part of Collingwood and many of his colleagues. And they've tried to persuade Nelson that perhaps Victory should hang back or that he should get on another ship. And Nelson, of course, absolutely scorns that because it's, you know, the whole mystique of Nelson's charisma is that he shares the dangers of his men. And in fact, as an officer, he is obliged to run more risks than his men because he is standing on the quarter deck, which is, you know, and all, as all officers do, they have to stand there. They can't cower. They can't duck. It requires absolutely phenomenal qualities of courage.
And Nelson, just to be, I mean, by the time he does get on deck, we can maybe just leap ahead for a second. You're talking about the courage. He is wearing his dark blue coat. I mean, you can see what Nelson wore in the National Maritime Museum.
Yeah, it's still there.
They've still got it, haven't they? But he's wearing his dark blue coat and he's got gilt buttons, 36 gilt buttons and gold epaulettes and stars adorned on the epaulettes. So he is absolutely visible. You know, if you're a Frenchman or a Spaniard, you will see Nelson literally glinting because of the stars and whatnot, surrounded by men who are clearly not officers or you know, the mass of the men on the ship. So Nelson is a target. I mean, that's really important. He is a very, very visible target.
Absolutely. And one of the things that makes what he's doing incredibly dangerous is that if you imagine two ships parallel to each other, firing guns at each other, the ribs of the ship serve as a kind of armor. But if you imagine them shooting at the stern or the rear, that's vulnerable. And, you know, if you fire cannonballs, say, through the prow, it can go straight through the ship. It's called raking.
Yeah.
So as Nelson on Victory and Collingwood on the Royal Sovereign approach the French and Spanish line, they will be raked. And they will not have an opportunity to fire back because their cannon will obviously not be pointing at the enemy line. So it requires unbelievable reserves of courage to do that. But that is that's Nelson's plan. And at 6:10 in the morning, he signals to the fleet, form order of sailing in two columns. So Victory at the head.
Yeah.
Royal Sovereign at the head of the second column.
Yeah.
6:22, another signal, prepare for battle. And so they start to move forward. 6:40, a French frigate signals to the Bucentaur, to Villeneuve on the French flagship, the enemy is in sight to windward. And as the British fleet slowly crosses over the horizon, Villeneuve is absolutely appalled to realize how many British ships there are. There are far more than he had calculated.
Yeah.
But he knows that, you know, he knows that if he retreats now, he's doomed. French honor will be lost. So he is determined to stand and fight. And so he kind of gives orders for his fleet to reverse direction, to turn northwards, to face the British, but they're unpracticed. And this maneuver generates the first Franco-Spanish mistake, which is that the tactical reserve under the command of Gravina, the Spanish admiral, gets jumbled up with all the other ships. And so it loses its coherence. And kind of gaps in the line start opening up.
Well, if you ever look at a plan of the battle, Tom, the French and Spanish, the combined fleet is meant to be a sort of a line, but it's actually quite raggedy and it's more of a kind of crescent, isn't it?
What this means is that Gravina's reverse force, rather than kind of entering as a solid unit, is just kind of entering pell-mell. And in the long run, it will kind of, you know, each one, it'd be like, you know, entering a meat grinder or something. So it's, things are not looking good for the Spanish fleet and the French fleet right from the beginning. The thing that makes the whole onset of the battle kind of unbelievable is that there's enough wind for the British to advance, but not enough for it to be anything more than a kind of walking pace. The British fleet is advancing kind of 2-3 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So
if it's a film, if you're making the film with the Battle of Trafalgar, I mean, the thing is that they see each other, they start to, you know, everyone is nervous, everybody's getting ready, but hours will pass.
Hours.
With them getting closer and closer. It's about 6 hours, I think, with them moving very, very slowly together. And the tension on board, I mean, the descriptions in the various books. So, for example, I mentioned earlier, what I think is one of the most extraordinary history books that I've probably ever reviewed which is John Sugden's, the second volume of his Life of Nelson, which is just so incredibly detailed. And I know you read a book on, is it by Tim Clayton? Is it Tim Clayton, somebody like that? About
Trafalgar? Tim Clayton and Phil Craig, but a really good account of the battle.
These amazing accounts of the Battle of Trafalgar, and what makes them so powerful is that sense of the tension building and building and building hour after hour. So they clear the decks, don't they, on the British ships. What you do is when you're getting ready for action, you take all the furniture
away. You take your hammocks down.
The hammocks down. You
and
lower
you put
the
them
ship's
up to
boats.
Kind of serve as padding, to kind of reinforce the sides of the deck.
The men strip to the waist. They sort of tie headbands or bandages around their heads so that it will keep the sweat out and protect their eyes. They do all that. But then there's still an awful lot of waiting. And actually on the British ships, so we started this whole epic and I read that Heart of Oak. I mean, that's one of the songs that they sing. The band strikes up.
Yeah, because the bands are playing.
The bands are playing. They sing Rule Britannia. They're singing God Save the King. At one point, they dance the hornpipe on board.
Well, also, Dominic, for breakfast, they've been given wine.
They have wine and meat, yeah. Wine unusually. On Villeneuve's ship, so the British are sort of singing Rule Britannia and dancing. On Villeneuve's ship, I was very pleased to read that he parades the Imperial Eagle.
That's right. It's been given, sent by Napoleon.
And his officers swear oaths of loyalty. They renew their oaths of loyalty to the Emperor. So, you know, it's the perfect, a sort of Hogarth figure, couldn't make this up. You know, the contrast between the sort of the high spirits of the British and the French swearing loyalty to an absolutist ruler.
But I think there's a seaman on Victory who says, we are like lions anxious to be at it. They're keyed up for the battle. Even though they know that lots of them are going to die, they seem to have a kind of battle frenzy. Whereas on one of the Spanish ships, one of the captains says the fleet is doomed. So there's
the guy from Dad's Army.
Yeah, we're doomed.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, they've developed this signalling, which Nelson has been using to kind of convey orders. And they have this famous, Nelson wants, England confides that every man will do his duty. This is the message he wants to convey. Yeah. Confides meaning trust. So England trusts that every man will do his duty. But they don't have a signal for confides. And so the signal says, could we use expects?
Yeah.
And so that's the message that goes up.
31 flags it took to signal that message. And there were conflicting reports, but some say, you know, the men cheer. They raise a great cheer when they see this.
Well, Collingwood thinks it's all a bit much. He complains that, you know, there are too many signals, that they know what to do. But then he reads the signal and he welcomes it as well. And hurrah, ready for battle. So slowly, the British fleet, pronged with, you know, Nelson and Collingwood, draw closer and closer and closer towards the enemy line. And a mile away, the French and Spanish start to fire. And the first shot flies over Victory. And Nelson has two captains with him on board. And so he says, you know, chaps, time to go. Off you go. And they head off. And he shakes the hands of one of the captains. And one of the captains takes Nelson's hand and said, I trust, my lord, that on my return to the Victory, which will be as soon as possible, I shall find your lordship well and in possession of 20 prizes. On which he, Nelson, made this reply, God bless you, Blackwood. I shall never speak to you again. So,
biographers have had enormous, you know, spent oceans of ink about that remark. Does Nelson feel, you know, the Grim Reaper peering over his shoulder? Does he, or is this what captains, people often say before a battle in which so many people they know will be killed?
Yeah.
And if they live, it's a remark that will be forgotten. But it lives on purely because he, I mean, who knows?
Well, so in the Victorian period, where they were very agitated by his relationship with Lady Hamilton, it became part of the myth that he felt ashamed of his relationship with Emma and was looking to re-burnish his sense of honor and was offering himself up as a sacrifice. And it is true that Nelson was obsessed with the death of James Wolfe at the Battle of Quebec in the Seven Years' War.
Yes.
And there was a famous painting by the American painter, Benjamin West, who became president of the Royal Academy, who Nelson had met at Fonthill in Wiltshire, very near where I grew up, and I played cricket there. And Beckford was it was owned by William Beckford, who was a kind of plantation owner, fabulously, dangerously rich sugar baron. And Nelson met West there, and said, well, you know, why aren't you painting more canvases like The Death of Wolfe? And West says, well, you know, there aren't any heroes. And Nelson goes, But I think the consensus among those who studied Nelson is that he had no sense of a death wish. I mean, he was not looking to sacrifice himself. He was not looking to offer himself up as a blood sacrifice to Britain to exonerate his shame or anything like that. But, you know, it's a tense moment. And they are going into hell.
Yeah. We may never meet again, isn't it?
I think so.
Nelson's quite a sentimental person, and he says very patriotic and sentimental things. That's how I perceive it. I don't think he's, because he thinks he's going to win. I mean, that's why he's devised the plan.
Yeah. I mean, he's confident he's going to win. But he also knows that he is going, as I say, going into the jaws of hell. And actually, it's Collingwood rather than Nelson who hits the enemy first, because the Royal Sovereign, Collingwood's flagship, has just had its hull newly coppered, so it's very, very fast. Gets ahead of Victory, gets ahead of the Belle Isle, which is the ship directly behind Collingwood. So it is first into the jaws of hell.
Yeah.
Then Victory as well. Collingwood is about 2 miles southeast of the Victory, and the cannon fire is starting to come. However, having said that, I think both Collingwood and Nelson know that it is not perhaps as dangerous as it might be, partly because the wind and the tide and the waves are against the enemy. So they're rolling up and down, very difficult to get a kind of direct aim. However, I think that neither Collingwood nor Nelson are kind of suicidally brave. And even though the cannon fire is starting to, you know, smash into the sail, smash into the masts, all kinds of things, cannon fire is whistling past, they know that the swell is with them. So the swell is going with them. It's moving them forward, but this is disrupting the ability of the French and Spanish ships to get a kind of steady aim, because their ships are kind of rolling up and down, up and down. And that means that basically, it's only for a few seconds every minute that the ships are level and therefore the cannon are level. And so actually the fire that is coming from the French and Spanish line is pretty irregular and very inaccurate. And on top of that, one of the technical advances that the British do have is that when they pull the trigger, it fires, whereas the French and Spanish have slow burning fuses. And that makes it even more difficult, because if you're lighting a fuse that then has to kind of slow burn and the ship is rocking up and down, I mean, basically, you know, it's impossible to target your fire accurately. Still, I mean, it's not fun, is it?
No, even so, the crew are told to, you would generally lie flat on the deck if you're under fire, except for the officers who are not allowed to do that, basically. So they are, you know, standing vertical targets for these hail of cannonballs that come sort of...
There's an unbelievably moving account from a lieutenant on the Belle Isle, which is the ship immediately behind Collingwood's flagship. So, I mean, absolutely in the front. And he's what, kind of 19, 20? He wrote after the battle that seeing that almost everyone was lying down, I was half disposed to follow the example and several times stoop for the purpose. But, and I remember the impression well, a certain monitor seemed to whisper, stand up and do not shrink from your duty. Turning round, my much esteemed and gallant senior fixed my attention. The serenity of his countenance and the composure with which he paced the deck drove more than half my terrors away. And joining him, I became somewhat infused with his spirit, which cheered me on to act the part it became me. And so that sense of being inspired by your senior officers is obviously terribly important. And that's why it's so important for Nelson that he, you know, he's prominent on the quarterdeck, and that all appeals from his junior officers for him to, you know, stop making himself such an obvious target. He absolutely refuses to do it.
We talked in the very first episode about the carnage and the horror of a battle like this. There were so many passages that I could have picked from the books we read. This is one from Ben Wilson's book, Empire of the Deep. And he says, for thousands of sailors on both sides, the battle was a glimpse into hell. The gun deck turned into a blackened, smoky furnace. Men slipped on the blood and viscera of their messmates as they fought. To continue to man the guns in these conditions required the utmost courage. An officer remarked that the side effects of battle, temporary deafness and the inability to see because of the gun smoke, helped because they blotted out the noise and vision of messmates dying. All the men had to keep them sane and grounded was the mechanical rhythm of loading, hauling, firing, hauling, loading, over and over and over.
But Dominic, I mean, remember, as they're approaching, they're not able to fire because they don't have a target.
So they are sitting ducks, basically, aren't they? Until they can finally get to grips with the combined French and Spanish fleets when they finally pierce the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And the closer they get, even with the swell and the slow-burning fuses, the artillery, the cannon fire starts to generate casualties. So before Nelson reaches the French and Spanish line, his secretary, a man called Dr. Scott, is standing next to him, gets killed by a cannonball.
Okay, well, a cannonball that literally rips him in two.
Literally.
I mean, this is the extent of the horror. Yeah.
Yes, so it's kind of takes off his body, doesn't it? His kind of legs are left standing there, and then they collapse. Is that poor Scott gone? Nelson asks, and he gets told it is. And also the other thing is it's not just the cannonballs, it's splinters from the wood that are kind of firing everywhere. And a splinter rips off the buckle of Hardy's shoe, which is kind of an amazing thing. And, eight Marines get killed on the deck of Victory by a single shot. And Nelson says to Hardy, you know, this is warm work to last long. And he knows they've got to get up close and then they can start the killing. And the ship that first does that is the Royal Sovereign. A Collingwood on the Royal Sovereign closing in on the Santa Ana, which is under the command of de Alva, commanding the vanguard. Adam Nicholson describes this brilliant phrase in his book, the cold silence of the approaching British guns. And the only shot that the Collingwood on the Royal Sovereign aims is a couple to create a kind of smoke screen. But they still not fired a shot in anger. And it glides past the Santa Ana. Collingwood aims right, swings round, and it passes under the windows of the stern of the Santa Ana. And now the Santa Ana is absolutely at its most vulnerable. And Collingwood can rake the Santa Ana.
Yeah.
And is able to rake it basically for about a minute as it
drifts
past.
So minutes of just constant hell coming from the guns of the British ship, just ripping through the Santa Ana, basically.
Because as I said, if you're aiming at the ribs of a ship, the side of a ship, you can't get through. But if you're aiming at it's kind of like a kind of soft, it's open.
Yeah.
You can aim artillery fire and it will go through all the decks right the way to the front of the ship. And so that minute that the Royal Sovereign is drifting past the stern of the Santa Ana, 240 of a crew of 800 are killed in the space of a minute.
Yeah.
And that is the impact of kind of close impact gunnery. That is the condition of chaos that Nelson has wanted to create.
I mean, imagine the scene, Tom, the smoke, literally people's heads, body parts flying through the air, splinters. I mean, splinters would kill an enormous number of people, wouldn't they?
Awful. It's absolute. Yeah. It's absolute chaos. Absolute carnage. Obviously, the moment that the Royal Sovereign has drifted past, more and more French and Spanish ships are kind of coming up, like I suppose, like kind of bees in a hive that's been disturbed. They're firing muzzle to muzzle, hugely playing to the British advantage. I mean, lots and lots of British sailors are dying. But they're losing maybe 25%. The French and Spanish are losing 50%.
Yeah.
And that's the margin of victory.
Well, this is an interesting thing because this is the Nelson knew, and the whole strategy was based on the fact that the British gunnery was quicker, more effective, more efficient. So they know that as many as they are losing, if they're still firing, they will inflict more damage on the enemy than the enemy can ever possibly inflict on them.
So essentially, those British casualties are the payment for the opportunity to force the surrender. So by 2:15 in the afternoon, Santa Ana has surrendered.
Yeah.
So that the strategy is bloody, it's brutal, it costs a lot of British lives, it costs even more lives, French and Spanish lives, but as far as the British are concerned, it works. Meanwhile, the head of the other line, Victory, has reached the enemy. It aims first at the Santissima Trinidad, the largest ship in the world, with its four decks, and then for the Bucentaur, Villeneuve's flagship with the eagle that has been given to it by Napoleon. It rakes the Bucentaur's stern, just as Collingwood had done. Nelson kills hundreds within that kind of, you know, that minute of concentrated lethal fire. Victory itself gets raked through its brow. And that's the moment that kills more people on board Victory than any other.
That's by the French ship Neptune or Spanish.
That's
ship,
right.
French
yes.
ship Neptune. Yeah.
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 A ship called the Redoutable.
Yes.
Commanded by very, very brave, tough captain called Jean-Jacques Lucas, blocks off Victory's Passage. So Victory is essentially stationary. And there's a kind of a piece of iron that gets caught and essentially solders Victory and Redoutable together so that the guns are just kind of firing away. Because otherwise, the force of the blast would have propelled Victory away from Redoutable, but it doesn't. And this essentially is what dooms Nelson.
Yeah.
Because Lucas and his men are desperate to board Victory, but even though they can't do that, they're absolutely packed with musket men. And Lucas, recognizing that he can never outgun the British gunners, he locks up the portholes so that it gets harder for the British cannonballs to get through, and relies on his muskets, his musketry, his soldiers. And that means a lot of musket balls firing.
Yes.
And 1:15 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Probably, I mean, I don't know, maybe you'd say that the arrow that killed King Harold at Hastings is the most famous shot fired in British history, but
this is up there.
This is certainly up there, isn't it? Probably, yeah. First equal. The shot is fired that hits Nelson, and he falls on his left side right into the blood where John Scott had been killed. And he gets drenched in Scott's blood. Yeah.
Yes.
So the decks are covered in sand to soak up the blood. And it's a measure of how much, you know, just how much carnage had been left by the destruction of Scott's upper body. The blood drenches Nelson. And he cries out, "They've done for me at last." And Hardy, who's standing next to him, says, "I hope not." And Nelson says, "Yes, my backbone is shot through."
So he's fallen. He's been, the musket ball has hit him in his left shoulder, gone through the epaulette, and it's picked up fragments of fabric as it passes. Yeah. And it goes down through his chest, severs an artery, I think round about his lung, and then lodges, it smacks into his backbone and lodges in his spine. And the force of it knocks him down onto his knees, and men cluster around him.
Take him below deck.
And so they realize he's got to go below deck straight away to the surgeon's cockpit. Four of them take him down the ladders. I mean, just imagine how unbelievably agonizing that must have been.
Well,
down these ladders.
And Nelson, of course, had lost his arm. It had been operated on. And one of the things that he specified before Trafalgar is fought is that the surgeons below deck should warm up their knives, because he remembered the chill of the iron.
Yeah. So, Tom, I think we should take a break on this, at this climactic moment, and then come back after the break to talk about what happens to Nelson and what happens
in the battle.
In the battle, yeah. So we'll see you in a couple of minutes. So welcome back to The Rest is History for this final concluding part of our Trafalgar epic. And Tom, before the break, Nelson was hit by a sniper from Redoutable. Nelson has been taken below decks to the surgeon, Dr. Beatty. But meanwhile, the Battle of Trafalgar is raging. And it is clear, I think, at this point that Nelson's plan is working.
Yes, because everything is totally unclear. No one really has any idea what's going on. It's absolute carnage. Ships are all kind of piling into it, onto one another. But this is playing to British strengths. And they just devastate the French and Spanish ships. More and more carnage. Ships smeared with blood. Sloshing all over. I mean, literally sloshing over the decks. Just unspeakable. And by 1:40, so that's almost half an hour after Nelson has been shot on the deck of Victory, Villeneuve on the Bucentaur surrenders. And before he surrenders, he makes sure that the eagle that has been given him by Napoleon is thrown overboard. And an hour after Nelson is shot, Victory at last drifts away from Redoutable.
So Redoutable, to give you a sense of the carnage, Redoutable had a crew of 643 men, and 300 of those men are killed, and 222 of them are wounded, and many of those wounds are pretty severe. So that gives you basically the vast majority of the men on that ship are either killed or very, very badly injured. I mean, the horror of fighting at sea is so often, I think, underestimated.
Well, that's the brutal reality of Nelson's ambition to fight a war of annihilation.
Yeah.
You know, I consider the destruction of the enemy's fleet of so much consequence that I would willingly have half of mine burnt to effect their destruction.
And it works.
That's because the bargain that he's made.
Yeah. You look at the stats, you look at the figures. So of Nelson's men, 460 of them or so were killed and about 1,200 injured. But of the French and Spanish, of those killed, wounded, or captured, the total is 14,000.
Yeah.
So that you know, that is a testament. I mean, everything we talked about, particularly in episode one, about the efficiency, the ruthless efficiency of the Royal Navy as a killing machine. I mean, Trafalgar is the ultimate testament to that, isn't it? Because they go straight into the battle, as you said, muzzle to muzzle, and it's the British who emerge by a gigantic margin.
Ten times. The French and Spanish lose 10 times.
Yeah.
The British losses. But of course, among the British losses, is probably the most famous man in Britain, Horatio Nelson himself. And even as the Bucentaur and other ships, French and Spanish ships, are surrendering, Nelson can feel, that he's paralyzed. He's seen what happens when someone gets shot in the spine. He's witnessed it for himself. He knows what's happening to him. The doctors try and cheer him up and say, "Oh, you'll be all right, my lord." But he says, "No, no, no." And of course, you know, he's lost control over his bodily functions. So he's urinating, shitting, bleeding.
Well, he says to the doctor straight away, "Dr. Beatty," I mean, this is classic Nelson. He says, "Ah, Mr. Beatty, you can do nothing for me. I have but a short time to live. My back is shot through." And he says to Beatty, "Don't worry about me. Look after your other patients." And then he says constantly, "Doctor, I'm gone, I'm gone." And he starts saying, "Remember me to Lady Hamilton. I have made a will. I have left Lady Hamilton and Horatia to my country." I mean, this line, his, you know, it's a sort of obsession for him that Emma Hamilton and their daughter will not be looked after. And it's about, I think, 2:30 that Captain Hardy, who, as you described Hardy, Tom, earlier on, I mean, Hardy is a huge man, isn't he? 6 foot
yes,
four
bald,
or something.
He's balding, stooping.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very kind of striking figure, very stern disciplinarian, but devastated by, I mean, loves, adores Nelson.
Yes.
And is absolutely devastated to see him dying, and come down to stay with Nelson about 3:30. So that's what, just over a couple of hours after he's been shot.
So Nelson takes quite a, for someone who's so badly injured, Tom, what struck me about this was I had, before I read up on it, I had this sort of vague idea that Nelson is shot, he's taken downstairs, and then he dies.
No, it's very protracted.
It's very protracted. So he's in agony for hours, asking for lemonade or asking to be fanned, being given wine, constantly saying, you know, he says again and again, "I leave Lady Hamilton and Horatia to my
So that's
country.
One obsession. And the other obsession, of course, is how is the battle going? So yeah. When Hardy comes down, he's saying, you know, "How goes the battle? How goes the day with us?" And Hardy's able to say, "Well, we've got about 12 or 14 of the enemy's ships." And Nelson's anxious that, you know, have the British lost any ships? And says, "No." And so he has that to,
but
keep
also
him going.
But you talked about Nelson and his attention to detail, his perfectionism. At one point later on, when Hardy comes down, you know,
the second time, isn't it? Yeah.
But when he comes down and he says, "How many?" And Hardy says, very emotionally, you know, he knows the gravity of the moment. He says, "You have won a complete victory. I'm certain that it's 14 or 15 of the enemy ships have surrendered." Now, we talked about the Battle of the Nile. How many ships had they sunk then? They'd sunk
two.
About two?
Yeah.
So this is a titanic,
unprecedented,
unbelievable victory. And Nelson says, "That is well, but I bargained for 20. You know, that sort of drive, even at the last. And then, of course, he says, "Take care of poor Lady Hamilton." And then there is this thing that, you know, schoolboys for generations in Britain have giggled about, where he says, "Kiss me, Hardy." And so Hardy leans forward and kisses him on the cheek. And Tom, do you know the story about Oberon War? I know this is a slight
No, you know, this is an unexpected turn.
It is. So
Evelyn Waugh's son.
Son of Evelyn Waugh, the novelist. He's was well known, particularly well known in Britain, late 20th century, great satirist, writer for Private Eye. Oberon Waugh did his national service, and I think he was fiddling with a gun in Cyprus or something, and the gun went off, and a burst of sort of machine gun fire or something went into him. And he was convinced he was dying. He's kind of lies on the ground, blood seeping out of him. And Oberon Waugh was a man steeped, you know, he'd read lots of history books. And he said to his second in command or whatever, kiss me, Chudley. Right. And this bloke just stared at him. But unfortunately, Oberon Wall then lived. And he said that from that point onwards,
Chudley would always look at him with some suspicion.
He looked at him with deep, deep suspicion because they didn't get the reference. Anyway, so...
But Hardy actually kisses Nelson twice, doesn't he?
He does kiss him.
He kisses
him
on the cheek and then he kisses him on the forehead. And Nelson by this point is so far gone that he doesn't know who it is. And he asks who it is, and it is Hardy. God bless you, Hardy.
Oh, it's so moving.
God bless you, Hardy.
I mean, of course, like all other 9-year-olds, when I came across this in my school textbook, we all sort of giggled and said, golly, kiss me, Hardy. What's going on there? But, you know, to read these descriptions now and the accounts of Trafalgar, it's incredibly moving. And then Nelson, in absolute, I mean, he always has this Hollywood quality.
Yeah, he really does.
It's about 4:30, he's dying, and his last word, I mean, there are different accounts, he either says, thank God I have done my duty, which he has said again and again, or some witnesses said his last words were, God and my country.
But both of them are box office, aren't they?
I'm determined that they will be my last words.
Well, I hope someone is on hand to
record
them
for
you.
Posterity.
And that's about 4:30, by which point it's very, you know, Nelson dies knowing that he has won the battle. All kinds of great prizes have been taken, including the Santissima Trinidad. A horrific description of the boarding party. So there's a ship, the Africa, that thinks that the Santissima Trinidad has surrendered. Boarding party goes on, and a midshipman, British midshipman, describes it. She had between 300 and 400 killed and wounded. Her beams were covered with blood, brains, and pieces of flesh, and the afterpart of her decks with wounded, some without legs and some without an arm. What calamities war brings on. Because the British, unless you're Nelson, the casualties get thrown overboard. The French and Spanish don't. They leave them there. But the it turns out when the boarding party land on the Santissima Trinidad that actually they haven't surrendered. That they were just taking a breather.
A break.
And the lieutenant who's led the boarding party apologizes and he withdraws. And it's all very, very good behavior. It's basically just bravado. It's bravado because there's nothing the Santissima Trinidad can done. And in due course, it gets captured taken in tow with her great cargo of dead. So basically, all the French and Spanish ships either get sunk or most of them get captured. The only ones that don't are the ships under Dumanoir, who is in command of the rear guard.
Right. Yes.
And he doesn't engage and. It's unclear why he doesn't. Some said it was cowardice. Some said that it was, he wanted to preserve something of the ship. And the only ship that does from his rear guard is a ship commanded by a French captain with the splendid name of Louis Affernay, who commands the Intrépide, plunges into the heart of battle.
Right.
Fights with absolutely suicidal bravery. And when the crew, they're all kind of dead or dying, and they finally agree to surrender. Affernay is so furious that they're surrendering that he has to be held down. And the British are unbelievably impressed by this and say that it deserves to be recorded in the memory of those who admire true heroism. And actually, the British are very, very impressed with how bravely the French and Spanish have fought.
They're surprised, aren't they? Because they thought they slightly underestimated the French and the Spanish, I think it's fair to say.
But the victory is total, and it's marked at 5:30, so an hour after Nelson has died, when one of the French ships literally explodes. And that is the end of, the battle, 5.5 hours. And it is, it's an absolutely thumping victory.
Yes, it is.
So the previous record for, a naval battle was the one that Nelson had got at the Nile. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
Which was 7 captured and 4 destroyed. The British have taken 12 ships as prizes and one has blown up. And also they take over 11,000 prisoners. As it turns out, so two things slightly cast a shadow on the victory at Trafalgar. One, of course, is the death of Nelson. The other is the fact that this swell that people had noticed in the early hours of the battle does indeed presage a storm. And this absolutely, you know, hits the Bay of Cadiz and Trafalgar and down to Gibraltar, causes absolute chaos. Lots of the prizes are sunk. One of the things that's actually very, very impressive, and the British behave very well, is that rather than just abandoning the French and Spanish prisoners on these ships, they risk their lives to save them. There's no example of British sailors abandoning their prisoners to their fate. And it's thought that perhaps 2,000 drown in the storm. They rescue from the Santissima Trinidad, they rescue a dog, a pug. So Collingwood would have approved of that with his love of dogs. And they end up only saving four prizes. And this, of course, is very bad news for everyone in the fleet, because what do prizes mean? Prizes mean cash.
Yes. Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. If you've ever read the Patrick O'Brien books, you know that they're obsessed with
prizes. That's what they're after.
Yeah.
So Parliament recognises this and actually coughs up money to try and make up the shortfall.
Oh, that's good. That's good form. That's unusually good political form.
Yes. So good behaviour from the British sailors in the aftermath of the battle, and good behaviour from Parliament.
So you were talking about the shadow. So the news doesn't reach England until, I think, about the 5th, 6th of November. And what's remarkable is that this crushing victory, which really we'll come to the significance of the battle in just a second, but you could argue it's decisive, not merely in the Napoleonic Wars, but in the course of the entire 19th century. People greet it with, they're as struck by the tragedy of the death of Nelson as they are by the glory of the triumph. So Pitt, William Pitt the Younger, he can't sleep when he's told about the victory. He gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning because he can't sleep. He's so upset about the death of Nelson. The king sits in silence, you know, unable to speak. Not because of madness, but because of grief.
I was gonna say
because of grief about Nelson's death. When people gather at the Admiralty buildings for news, they hear the news and they stand there in a sort of a somber, broken silence because Nelson was such a hero to them. And then Nelson's body, when it's finally brought back, so Nelson's body had been kept in a barrel with spirits.
A cask of brandy,
yeah,
isn't it?
Brandy, yeah. And then replaced with wine, I think,
with
at Gibraltar.
Wine. Yeah.
And he lies in state in Greenwich in the Painted Hall. If anyone hasn't been to the Painted Hall in Greenwich, it is the most extraordinary building. I mean, the magnificence of the Navy is sort of embodied, isn't it, in the complex, great complex at Greenwich. And then he has a state funeral. At that point, the biggest state funeral in history.
And it's not in Westminster Abbey.
In St. Paul's.
Which, yeah. It's in St. Paul's. And it's kind of, and he's buried in, is it Cardinal Wolsey's?
It is.
A coffin built for Cardinal Wolsey.
Yeah. And you know, it's a massive scene, and there's all kinds of stuff with men from the victory ripping up flags sort of very moving.
Well, so this is an age when Britain is notorious for being absolutely hopeless at state funerals and, you know, pomp.
Yeah.
So anyone who watched the Queen's funeral may be surprised to know that Britain was a byword for uselessness at this kind of thing. But Nelson, they really pull the stops out, and it's a great success. And you know who's there at the funeral? Is poor old Villeneuve.
Oh, no.
He's been taken back. He's been sent to Reading.
Right. As punishment.
He's kept there as a prisoner. And then he has to attend the funeral. And then poor man, he gets sent back to France in 1806. And it's clearly not going to end well with him. And he's found dead. And there's much debate as to whether he is murdered or commits suicide.
He would have been better off staying in Reading, Tom. It's not often I say that phrase.
Yes, he would have been. But interesting, there's absolutely no mention of Trafalgar whatsoever in the French press. Le Isn't Moniteur.
They don't even mention it.
No, not a mention.
Oh, dear.
Not a mention.
The naval campaign has worked out not necessarily to our advantage.
Don't say a word. So the significance of it. So there is a case which has been made by lots of historians of Napoleonic Wars that actually it changes nothing.
Yeah.
That in 1806, there are two squadrons from Brest that go out, that over the course of the decade that follows, Napoleon is endlessly building new ships. I think by 1814. He has about 100 ships. That nothing really changes. I think the significance is absolutely enormous. I mean, those two squadrons from Brest get finished off very rapidly. Napoleon is reduced basically to trying to grab ships off other powers. So that's the Second Battle of Copenhagen.
Yeah.
When the British go in and grab the Danish ships. And there's a case for saying, isn't there, that the ambition to essentially reconstruct a navy distorts Napoleon's entire geopolitical strategy. It's what leads him to, you know, turn on Spain, his ally at Trafalgar, and to invade it. And that becomes the disaster of the Peninsular War. And in the long run, it kind of leads him to invade Russia.
It does, because what happens is that the Royal Navy can now enforce a blockade of Europe, unchallenged by a French and Spanish fleet. Napoleon has this idea of the continental system to try and keep the British out of Europe, to keep British imports out and so on. But effectively, over the years, the Navy has this blockade of the continent. It seizes the merchant marine trade of most of Europe, dominates the coast, dominates commerce. So Napoleon's empire, which is a continental empire, is gradually being squeezed. In his insistence on dragging other European powers into his system, he turns on Russia. You know, that's what he wants. That's the casus belli to some extent. He wanted the Russians to close their ports to British ships, and they wouldn't do it. The campaign of 1812, you know, all of this flows from, to some extent, from that defeat in 1805. And as you said beforehand, what 1805 also does is it means that when the war is over, Britain has all its colonies, it has control of the sea lanes, it has control of the merchant marine, it has control of international commerce, and it is supremely well placed to benefit from the years of peace and to build up its kind of imperial commercial supremacy. So I think all of that arguably,
and of course one should say that, you know, at Trafalgar there were three different types of society. There's the Ancien Régime of Spain. There was the revolutionary Republic of France,
yeah.
And there was the kind of
constitutional monarchy of the
industrial constitutional monarchy of Britain. But essentially, the frameworks that will underpin global industrialization and capitalism are laid, you could argue, in the decades that follow Trafalgar. Mm-hmm. As a result of British control of the shipping lanes.
Yeah.
And of course, also, it's, you know, it's not just about the establishment of imperialism and of industrial capitalism, but also, say, the abolition of the slave trade would have been impossible for the Navy to enforce had they not had domination of the seas.
Well, so here's the thing about Trafalgar, I would say. I'd say, on the one hand, it's the victory of British modernity. So it's the victory of a hugely disciplined Navy, of gun crews who've been trained, and all of that takes money, and it's a victory of bureaucracy. It's the victory of Pitt and his finance and taxation and a system of government borrowing and all of those things. It's the victory of an increasingly industrialized, kind of financialized society. And yet, as you said, and I think you're absolutely right, it's also a story that belongs with the kind of Homeric legends. Because of Nelson dying in the moment of victory, and this figure who had always seen himself, as you said, as the kind of, what did you call him, the Christian Achilles?
The Christian Achilles, yes. Yeah.
Is that your own phrase, Tom?
That's my own phrase, yes.
Very nice.
Myself.
Yeah, I like that.
I think, I mean, so I think that Trafalgar really, I mean, is the making of British imperialism in the 19th century. And obviously attitudes to British, the attitudes I would have to that story are more nuanced than when I read about the Battle of Trafalgar when I was, you know, 10.
Right.
And more complicated and more ambivalent, perhaps. But I still cannot help but thrill at the drama and the epic quality of the courage on display at Trafalgar.
Yeah.
And that's how I mean it being epic, rather in the way that I do to Achilles, even though he's killing lots of people. There is a kind of, the quality of heroism I do find stirring. And oddly, that there are people in Britain who the sense of kind of revulsion at perhaps the ferocity of what Nelson represents isn't a purely 21st century phenomenon. It is there in the radical counterculture in Regency London. So William Blake would be an obvious spokesman for them. So he did a painting in 1809, which he described as that it's Nelson guiding Leviathan, in whose wreathings are enfolded the nations of the earth. So that's a kind of very, perhaps, you know, 21st century response to what Trafalgar is about. But I'm with Wordsworth, who before Trafalgar, but he's got Nelson in his mind. He's probably got the Battle of the Nile in his mind. In a poem called Home at Grasmere, he wrote, "I cannot at this moment read a tale of two brave vessels matched in deadly fight and fighting to the death, but I am pleased more than a wise man ought to be. I wish, I burn, I struggle, and in soul am there." Now, nothing would make me want to be at the Battle of Trafalgar, but I do read it and I feel a sense of the drama and the power of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember I mentioned a few times John Sugden's brilliant biography, and the last line that I wrote when I reviewed that for the newspapers, I said it was a tribute to his achievement that as Nelson lies stricken below decks, gasping for air, blood pouring into his chest, his officers biting back the tears and Hardy wringing his hand, you pray that somehow, against all sense and reason, England's greatest hero might just pull through. And I think you do feel that reading the accounts of the battle. Yeah, I felt that even now, that is this tremendous story. He's an absolutely extraordinary character, that charisma, the concern for his men, the dash, the vigor, the self-belief. And it does feel, I mean, use the word Hollywood, I mean, it does feel like a Hollywood ending, dying in the moment of triumph.
Well, I mean, he is up there with Beau Brummel and Byron as a kind of proto-film star. I mean, he is a media celebrity as well as everything else. But I mean, he is so much more than that. And Andrew Lambert, who wrote another biography of Nelson, his summary was that Nelson met and defeated the greatest challenge to the independence and prosperity of his country through his genius for war, moral and political courage, and willingness to make the ultimate sacrifice. And I think it's worth paying tribute to those qualities, no matter how shaded by ambivalence the
I'm not ambivalent.
The ultimate consequences.
Are you ambivalent? I'm not ambivalent.
Yeah, to a degree. Yeah.
This is the difference between Chipping Norton and South
Dominic,
London.
Well, Dominic, you're doing your series of children's books, aren't you?
Yeah.
Adventures in Time.
Yeah.
Perfect opportunity to tell the story of Nelson for a young generation of patriots. And who are you doing it on?
Well, I'm going to be, okay, fine.
Listen, you're going to do Napoleon.
I'm going to do
Napoleon. Why do you hate Britain, Dominic?
But Nelson will be in it, Tom. Napoleon is the villain. Napoleon is the villain
of that
book.
I think you should do it on Nelson.
Come on.
I think you should rip your plans up and do it on Nelson.
There's too much Lady Hamilton, I would say. I don't think the young readers will have much tolerance for that kind of carry on. They won't want more fighting. Anyway, listen. This is an incredibly pathetic ending.
I'm calling on you for the good of the nation.
Well, Tom, you've missed a trick. Surely, what you should be saying is England expects.
I expect. Dominic.
Yes,
I expect.
So, Horatio Nelson, I think we can safely say, a friend of the rest is history, a very close
well,
friend.
Well, I think we'll come back to him because we've looked at how he died. We've looked at the last year of his life, but I think that the entire course of his career is so dramatic and extraordinary.
And given that Tom managed to compile 7,000 pages of notes on the Battle of Trafalgar, I dread to think what he'll come up with for Nelson. So listen, thank you very much for sticking with us through all this. Tom, dare I say, it has been a tour de force, and your desire to do multiple episodes on the Battle of Trafalgar has been triumphantly vindicated. So I hope you're satisfied.
Well, what I would like to say is that those of you who are members of the Rest History Club, a very, very happy Trafalgar Day. Those of you who aren't, I hope you had a good Trafalgar Day on Friday. And I raise a toast to the glorious memory. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.